although Jack LaLanne is the guru of exercise, now we're proud to introduce Jack LaLanne and his new Juicifier. That's right, Jack LaLanne has come out with a product to help you stay healthy, healthy as Jack is. Now, here's Jack LaLanne to tell you about his amazing Juicifier.
Hello, everyone, and I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to come into your homes this beautiful day. I'm Jack LaLanne, and I'm proud to introduce to you my Juicifier. If you use my Juicifier, you'll live a happier, healthier life. In fact, you may live to be as healthy as me, Jack LaLanne. I've been dead for 5 years, and my body doesn't even know it yet. Now that's healthy, folks. That's healthy. I'm going to give you a demonstration today of exactly what my Juicifier does. My Juicifier is amazing. Let's see what this baby can do. Let me see. I'm going to load it with a few items. Where are my vegetables at? Let me think. Here we go. We're going to put in some of this.
Jack, that's a gym bag, Jack. That's got your gym clothes in it, Jack.
Yeah? And then, how about one of these? Yeah?
Jack, that's the tissue I've been using to wipe my nose with all morning.
Is that Juicifier working? And then, one of these things there. This will work.
Jack, for God's sake, that's your cat. Jack, go put the cat in your phone.
Yeah. Can you hear that Juicifier working? It's making healthy juice that's going to make your life long and happy. Now, what you've got is a tasty, vitamin-enriched drink, which is sure to make your life a much more pleasurable and healthy experience. And who knows, your body may go on living years after you're dead, too, just like Jack LaLanne. If I could pull a boat with my teeth, that should tell you my juice is awesome. I'm Jack LaLanne. I can pull things off with my teeth. I pulled off bras, skirts, pantyhose. I owe it all to my health and my Juicifier. The Jack LaLanne Juicifier wouldn't be complete without its special safety features. If you notice, when I stick my hand in the Juicifier...
For God's sake, Jack, that thing just cut off two of your fingers. We gotta get you to a hospital.
Hello? 911?
See that? Not a scratch on me. That's because Jack LaLanne believes in safety and health and exercise. And I like to come into your home with my tight pants and exercise. Yeah, make you healthy and exercise and come into your home uninvited. And did I tell you I've been dead for 5 years? Not bad, huh, ladies? This is Jack LaLanne telling you, buy my Juicifier now. Get one before it's too late and you and your body are dead. Don't you want your family to be healthy? Okay, folks, see you around.
Families across America are enjoying Jack LaLanne's juice from his Juicifier.
I serve nothing but Jack LaLanne juice to my family. I want them to be healthy, and I want my husband to live even after he's dead. Here you go, kids.
Oh, God, Mom, what is this crap? Last time I drank this, I sat on the toilet for 3 weeks. This stuff is...
Here you go, honey. Drink your Jack LaLanne juice so that you can live after you're dead.
Oh, God. What is that nasty? Are you trying to kill me, you... Where's that insurance policy? Did you take an insurance policy out on me again? Damn it. God, I feel like I'm about to puke.
Being healthy isn't always easy, but it's a lot easier with Jack LaLanne's Juicifier. Thank you, Jack LaLanne. You're the best. Sorry that you died 5 years ago, but I'm glad you're still around to talk to us.
Yes, Jack LaLanne has been amazing us with his health for years and years. How does he do it? His special Juicifier. That's right, the Juicifier that makes, well, it makes juice that's good and keeps you healthy and helps you live a longer life. Just look at Jack LaLanne. He doesn't look a day over 159. The Juicifier is now available for the low, low price of 62 payments of $49.82. That's an amazing price for your health, don't you think? You can put anything in it, and out comes a nutritious, healthy, vitamin-enriched, drink-like substance. Jack LaLanne's Juicifier. Get one today.
I'm lying dead away. This is Ghostly Talk.
Author, lecturer, and guide, John Anthony West, delivered a seismic shock to the archaeology in the early 1990s when he and Boston University geologist Robert Schock revealed that the Great Sphinx of Giza, Egypt, showed evidence of rainfall erosion. Such erosion could only mean that the Sphinx was carved during or before the rains that marked the transition of northern Africa from the last ice age to the present interglacial epoch, a transition that occurred in the millennia from 10,000 to 5,000 BC. And we've had him on the show before.
Oh, a long time ago.
This was like, we were talking, I think it was about 4 years
ago. About 4 years ago.
And it is about time we brought...
I mean, the Sphinx wasn't even built then.
I know. It seems like one of those epics that we're talking about. We're glad to welcome back John Anthony West to the show. Your website is www.jawest.net. And welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Scott. A pleasure to be back, and just as a point of interest, the website is now, apart from jawest.net, somebody bought for me the domain name jawest.com. So
thank goodness. Oh,
so I'm now both calmed and netted, and very, very easy to find.
You've got them all, then. That's awesome. Yeah.
And we got you on Skype here, obviously, so if there's anybody asking questions, you're on Skype. That's why you sound so crystal clear and clean.
Yes, we love the Skype.
We love the Skype thing. It
had nothing to do with Skype. It has to do with my natural clarity.
Exactly. Who am I kidding? I'm sorry.
That's right. I mean, other people would be muddled on Skype. Me.
So, you know, 4 years, we were saying this just when we called you, we were saying 4 years is indeed like a long time. The world really is a completely different place.
It is.
And, I mean, politically, economically, and undoubtedly... within the, even though archaeology moves at a snail's pace,
well, that's what,
the
yeah.
fights happen very, very quickly.
Dr. Schock said that to us when we talked to him for the first time. I think we had him on the show, and then we had you on the show the next night. We were doing like all these bonus shows, and I remember one of the things that Dr. Schock said that sticks with me to this day. He's like, you know, when you're studying rocks, a million years is nothing. Everything we deal with, the time is stretched out much longer, much like astronomy and things like that.
Right.
You know, what we consider a long time here, you know, could be like, you know, a couple hours. It just depends on the circumstances you're in. But when it comes to rocks and geology and things like that, a million years really ain't that very long. Go ahead.
When it comes to rocks and when it comes to changing ideas in academia, that's even slower than rocks. That moves like Pluto in orbit.
Yes, I believe that.
And until you're actually involved in something controversial, you cannot believe what goes on in these so-called disciplines.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, when did you and Dr. Schock set out exactly? I mean, if you can give me maybe a year or something like that. When did you guys, I don't even know what maybe even sparked this idea or whatever it may have been, but approximately what year did you guys start your research on what we're talking about tonight?
No, it's not approximate. It's very precise.
Okay.
I mean, I got interested in the work of R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch in the 60s, 67 or 68, thereabouts. And then moved to London, and one thing led to another, and then I discovered his work and talked about it in my first nonfiction book. Remember, I started out as a novelist and playwright and screenwriter and had no thoughts of doing scholarship, much less heretical scholarship. Mm-hmm. My original aim from the get-go was to make as much trouble as possible. but I never thought it would take the form of scholarship. Mm-hmm. Anyway, in... The the first mention of Schwaller, because Schwaller was only in French in those back in those days. It hadn't been translated. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a whole long chapter in my first nonfiction book, which is called The Case for Astrology, which was a fairly successful book, subsequently rewritten and republished and now again out of print. And in there, I talked extensively about Schwaller. That led to a contract to do a book just on Schwaller, because whose work, as I said, was not in English and therefore inaccessible for the most part to an English-speaking audience. So in doing the research for that book, that Serpent in the Sky, and that book took 6 years or so to write in the early 70s, and in doing that work, I found this one line of Schwaller is just a kind of a throwaway line where he's talking about the chronology of Egypt and the belief that by the ancient Egyptians themselves that their civilization dated back many thousands of years earlier than dynastic Egypt, which of course is just simply dismissed out of hand by the quack academics. Mm-hmm. And I just a throwaway line, and of course the Great Sphinx of Giza shows unmistakable signs of water erosion. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, it was revelatory. I mean, the penny dropped in the slot, and I said, ah, that's geology. Everything else that he's talking about is an argument about the interpretation of texts. And so there are better and worse interpretation of texts, but you can't turn it into a science. And weathering, that was a science. That was geology. I'm not a geologist, but I knew enough to know that if you could prove that the Sphinx was weathered by water, because I'd done a little bit of reading into Egyptian the geology of Egypt, and I knew that the Sahara had formed around 10,000 B.C., uh-huh. And before that it was fertile savanna, and got complicated before that. But anyway, if you could prove that and now, of course, it's been dead, absolutely arid since dynastic Egypt, roughly 3,500 B.C., so that if you could prove the Sphinx was weathered by water, not by wind and sand, immediately you would have to revise all of history. There was no two ways about it. I mean, that was the only... you could no longer keep the timeline, because if the Sphinx was weathered by water, it would mean the greatest sculpture on Earth, unquestionably, mm-hmm. and the buildings around it, which are coeval with it, which involved techniques, structural techniques that we can't reproduce today, mm-hmm. existed at a time when there's not supposed to be any civilization at all. Mm-hmm. So I suddenly realized here was an opportunity to realize my dream of making a lot of trouble.
Boy, did you.
Yeah. Oh, it's still going on. Anyway, so I did my research. I mean, I just took time off and spent, I don't know how long, 6 months, a year, reading up on geology and developed the whole theory of the Sphinx being water weathered. And then the book Serpent in the Sky was published, and it found a little niche cult, if you want to call it that. I hate that word, cult audience. But basically, it was hardly a bestseller. And through, again, strange sets of circumstances, all of this, actually, I talk about a lot of this stuff on my audio blogs. Anybody's interested, they should go to my website and then click on the Phoenix. I have a series intermittent of audio blogs where I go into this stuff in a lot of detail, and so I have a whole hour, as much time as I want, it's my own show, to talk about the water weather in question and all of these. So anybody sufficiently interested should go to my website, mm-hmm. now, jawest.com, and click on the Phoenix Fire stuff, and if you're interested enough, just listen to some of those programs about the Egypt, particularly the first 6 or 7 programs about Egypt, because there I can really go into the story, and the story it's a very interesting story, and one of these days I will work it up into a full-scale book, or maybe a book co-written with Schock. Anyhow, mm-hmm. Long and short of it is that the book was published, nobody paid any attention, or not many people. I tried to find geologists to look into and critique my theory, but I couldn't find any. They'd either not respond to my inquiries at all, or they would respond very rudely. And then eventually, again, through another weird set of circumstances, I had a friend who liked my work who was a teacher at Boston University, a teacher, an English teacher, and he met for a dinner, and the guy said, you know, this whole thing of symbolist Egypt is really an important, this is Schwaller's work, Symbolist Egypt. I'm his self-appointed Boswell, but it's his work, not mine. But when I came across that work, actually, back in the 70s, I mean, I recognized it as an immensely valuable work of scholarship. In my view, maybe the most important single work of scholarship ever written, and because it really changed all of history around of the understanding of what the ancient civilizations actually knew. So I was very proud to be, Schwaller, who is now deceased, to be his spokesman. Anyway, so this friend at BU said, well, you know, this is really important work, and Symbolist Egypt, and you know, is there anything I can do from my academic position to further it? And instantly, I mean, I didn't even have to think about it. I said, yeah, you know, find me an open-minded geologist to look into the whole water weathering theory about the Sphinx. And I laughed because I use it in my talks all the time, that finding an open-minded scientist is about as easy as finding a fundamentalist Christian who loves his enemies. So this guy said, wait a minute. He said, there's somebody in my teachers in my school at BU, and he's young, but he's very highly credentialed. He's had a number of books published already. And he could be interested. He said, but don't you say anything. You're too incendiary. Let me handle this. He disappeared with all of the evidence and pictures and texts and blah, blah. And I didn't hear from him for months. And I write him periodically or phone. No email in those days. Now we're talking early 80s, middle 80s. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, you know, I showed him the stuff. And he's really skeptical, but he is interested. And he wouldn't tell me his name. And he said, but he doesn't want to touch it until he's up for tenure. And I laughed because he's right, because if you're going to redate the Sphinx and you're going to push it back,
you better make sure you got a job at the end of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yes, exactly. You're talking about the lost civilization. That's the A word, Atlantis. And so nobody better know that you're interested in that if you're up for 10. Anyway, it's a long time. Years went by. And now we're talking 89 or 90. And so then Schock was up for tenure, and for whatever reason, I'm not exactly sure what it was, but as long as he was up for it, he didn't mind it going public. So he organized a talk for me at Boston University for the faculty and interested students, and then we met. That was the first time we met. I didn't even know his name. My friend wouldn't tell me his name. So then we met, and actually it was a very interesting meeting, because, I mean, I took one look at Chuck, and I said, oh, yeah, he's odd, he's bizarre and strange enough so that he could be an ally. He wasn't one of them either, even though he had the PhD in geophysics and whatever it is, paleontology from Yale and all of these credentials. He looked odd enough to not fit into the university, to the whole university. You know, establishment.
Yeah, which of course is a great compliment.
To me. He could afford to think for himself. And so anyway, that started off the whole thing. And then one thing led to another. And of course, there was no money. And, you know, I scraped together a little bit to get him over the first time. And, you know, then he got really interested. Although, again, I've got a lot of this stuff on my audio blog, because it really is a funny story, and if I start telling the story, we'll use up the whole hour, and we won't even have been on our first trip there. Anyhow, one thing led to another, and so then he became convinced, and then it led to the first presentation at the Geological Society of America's annual meeting, which is sort of the Super Bowl of geology, where everything new gets aired, and that was a big press conference, and then that led through another series of circumstances to meeting to the NBC special, you know, hosted by Charlton Heston, which won an Emmy and won me an Emmy personally, and was nominated for Best Documentary of the Year of '93. And then that started out the whole huge controversy. I mean, this blast of abuse from the Egyptologists and the archaeologists. But the geologists were practically 100% in favor of it, which is where we stand at this day, except it's a big chunk of it is our fault. We haven't yet got together our panel of geologists to go and study the matter in Egypt firsthand. And it's really more, I mean, the science is all done. This part, one of the reasons Shock has been very, I really had to talk him into understanding the necessity for this major effort of PR. It's really public relations. It's not the science. The science is all done. We don't need any more science. It's proved. And any other, if it were anything else in the world other than rewriting all of history, it would have been accepted long ago. Geologically, there's no problem. The geologists look at it and say, oh, yeah, well, of course it's water weathering. But then when the, the implications get... Once you spell out the implications, then everybody says, oh, wow. I mean, holy mackerel, you mean everything we've learned about ancient civilization in our schools and our universities, be they Harvard or Yale or Princeton, or in fact, especially if they're Harvard or Yale or Princeton, is completely wrong. You have to completely change your mind about everything you ever learned in school about the human past. And all of that hinges upon the Sphinx being weathered by water and not by wind and sand. So,
yeah, because, well, and that's... We've had this conversation more than once, believe me, John. Doug and I have.
Yeah.
I was just talking with my neighbor about it the other day, as a matter of fact. We were talking about this particular thing, and you know, I kind of explained, you know, the high level, you know, of yours and Dr. Shock's work. And I did say the same thing. I'm like, you know, now what do you think, you know, after hearing that and hearing the redating of this thing, past 10,000, 12,000 years now possibly, what do you think about that? And, you know, my neighbor was like, that means everything I learned was just, you know, garbage.
That's right.
Not good. Yeah. It isn't garbage, but, I mean.
Good for him. That's right. That's right.
He's like, it's totally, totally different. I mean, as far as that as an implication, now, and I mean, I don't want to get too political with this thing, but obviously. Okay, let's get political. But obviously that is a major punch in the face too for the Egyptian, I mean for Egypt itself.
Well, how had they done it before? Why was their pride hurt? You know, because whoever dated the Sphinx before and said, "Oh, no way it could have been back then."
No, their pride, that's just stupidity on their part.
Because
we're not saying, other people say, oh, yeah, you know, the Sphinx has to, I mean, the pyramids have to be a gift from God because the Egyptians weren't clever enough to build the pyramids, or, you know, the Atlanteans. And actually, The Serpent in the Sky is published in 78 or 79. I mean, this is, you know, it's around 30 years. And even when I wrote that, long before I came across Shock, and well before I understood the kind of controversy that this would generate, I had the sense when I talked about the age of the Sphinx, because I developed this theory. And really, I was right about most stuff. The one thing I was wrong about was that it was rainwater weathering. The thing that I read talked about rainwater weathering, and that's a crucial piece of the theory. So I didn't have that right. Anyway, I had the sense when I used the dreaded A word, Atlantis, to put it between inverted quotation marks, because I wasn't talking about a particular place. I was talking about a civilization, a lost great civilization that corresponded to however roughly, to Plato's account of Atlantis.
Right.
But, of course, when you're dealing with the quackademics, they don't actually read what you say. They read what they want. They think you once said. So the Egyptologists, and you know, particularly the Egyptian authorities, simply misread what I was saying. I wasn't saying that it wasn't built by the Egyptians. It just wasn't the dynastic Egyptians. It was whoever was in Egypt at that time. And remember, we're not even talking about a 10,000 date. That's one of the possible dates, which is contingent upon the reason that the 10,000 date is chosen is because the Sphinx shrieks out as a Leo marker, that it has something to do with the age of Leo. And the last age of Leo, when the sun rises in the spring equinox against the backdrop of the zodiac, the last time it rose against the backdrop of the zodiac and the sign was Leo, was around 10,000 B.C. But for a variety of reasons that I won't go into here, because, again, it's another 10 minutes of explanation, the precession of the equinoxes is a 26,000-year cycle, and the age of Leo prior to 10,000 B.C. is 36,000 B.C. or thereabouts. And oddly enough, that corresponds pretty roughly, but close enough, to the Egyptians' own account in these texts that Schwaller talks about, takes it back to the first revelation when Schwaller is talking about the age of Egypt, that the Egyptians themselves talk about the foundation of their own civilization way back somewhere 34,000, 36,000 B.C. The texts themselves are a little bit degenerate and fragmentary, so there are bits and pieces missing and blah, blah, blah. But so it might not even be 10,000 B.C., which is outrageous enough, but a full cycle before that. So you can see, you can appreciate how radical this whole notion is, but it's not, you know, it's not pie in the sky. It's not aliens coming down from outer space, although, I mean, if you read enough about UFO evidence, you have to be an imbecile to deny the fact of UFOs. But, I mean, having said that, it's amazing how many imbeciles there are out there. They are a majority, in case you haven't noticed.
Yes, we noticed. They usually come out in the summer, too. In the winter, they're safely tucked away in their houses or their domiciles.
They come out and search.
And then as soon as it heats up, they release themselves unto the world, and we all are.
Are you aware of the latest? You know who Michael Shermer is?
Yes.
Did you read the latest? His what does he call it? Something, a baloney detector or something, where he's giving the debunker of a version of what reality is. I mean, it's actually pretty brilliant. He's got me inspired to bring up again something I invented back in the 70s called the Anti-Science Society that gives out ASS awards to deserving scientists who've done more than anyone else to actually make science look ridiculous and stupid.
Well, let's,
and
you know what?
Shermer is high on the list.
John, you know what? And that ties in with progress. And what I want to do is, let's take a quick break. We got to take a break for a second. But when we come back, that's one thing you mentioned here on our list, and I thought it was really interesting. Was the Church of Progress versus real civilization.
That would be a great thing.
Because it ties in with the story of the reading of the Sphinx. It ties right in there. And I know
it does, yes.
I know where it's going to go. I want to finish this thing out.
And I think we'll definitely see some examples, maybe even in modern times, of what was going on.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is not just a quibble among academics. This is serious. It's very funny, but it's serious.
I can't wait. So after this,
how long is our break?
About 5 minutes.
Yeah, not even that.
Oh, that's fine. So grab it for me to get another vodka. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, we're gonna go to break, you guys. Listen to the independent music, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes or so.
Yes.
With more from John Anthony West.
For more info, visit ghostlytalk.com.
The chance to get even the tiniest peek at who or what is on the other side.
PPR.
Cooperative for Paranormal Research, is one of these groups. We are dedicated to finding the answers, dedicated to finding evidence of the paranormal, and dedicated to proving that some places are truly haunted.
Don't be caught bored waiting for something to go bump in the night. Listen to the Paranormal Broadcast System with Brad, Brandon, Todd, and Paul.
Well, hello, Mr. Phantom Man.
Listen to some great interviews with some amazing guests that run the gamut from ghost hunting groups across the country to paranormal personalities in the media. First, let's be serious for a moment. Then let's have some fun! We've got it all covered. Tune in and listen to intriguing interviews with our hosts from L.A. Spirits and the Louisiana Spectral Research Center. Then kick back and listen to us try to be funny with some crazy Cajun. And some other guys, too. This is no kid show, folks. It's the Paranormal Broadcast System. Listen to us poke fun at ourselves. It's funnier that way. You can find us at www.lagghosts.com. That's www.lagghosts.com.
you want to dive into the bizarre world of the paranormal? Do ghosts, UFOs, or the supernatural amaze you to the point of wanting to learn more? Well then, you need BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network. With more than 1,200 hours of on-demand talk radio, syndicated from more than 35 shows, the Black Vault Radio Network is your one-stop shop for the world of the unexplained. Check us out and tune in 24 hours a day at www.blackvaultradio.com. Again, that's www.blackvaultradio.com.
I'm sorry, Black Vault Radio Network.
There's been a few times on this show, in the history of this show, where we've accidentally left the mics on.
Yeah.
Which means, you know, we always have good time on the break, but, you know, you guys miss a lot of funny stuff that goes during our breaks because, you know, it's a, yeah. Are you into the bizarre?
Well, what you should do is only do commercials with leave your own mics on so you're commenting on the
commercials. Yeah, we're commenting on the commercials.
Go through all this trouble of having speakers on there.
I remember one time we did it. We brought a new board into the production and we were trying to figure it out. We had all these wires going all over the place and I don't know. I think you were out of town for this thing, so this was like back in like 2004, 2005 or something like that. And I'm trying to figure the thing out and I left the mics on. And we were talking to our guest, you know, we got him on the phone, we were talking to him, and we're like, okay, well, you know, we just want you to enjoy yourself, have a good time. It's, you know, our usual thing. Whenever you come on, anybody comes on here, they know how we approach this thing. And then somebody in the chat room is like, you left your mic, the mics are, I'm like, oh my God, so I pushed the button. They're like, well, that's cool, because you guys are exactly the same as you are on the air, though.
Pretty much.
Ah, that was your...
So I'm like, well, that's a compliment then. That's cool.
That's a huge compliment.
I felt good about that. Like, not like, you know, okay, Dance Monkey, get on the air now. You know, no, it's, you know, so I felt good about that.
Somebody wake Doug up and put him in his seat.
Yeah. The dangerous part is when you're... You're one thing on the air, and the thing gets left on, and then you're this totally other character.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and that has happened.
Often.
Not because we're bad people when we're off the mic, but, you know, I tend to have a little different. We all have a little different lingo. Our language
might
be a little more
radio-ese.
Our language might be a little more colorful.
We don't edit. self-edit.
You know, hey, whatever. But no, it's happened. But no, I was happy about that. Now, we were talking before the break, though. We got to give it this. I mentioned before the Church of Progress, which, you know, I love that. The Church of Progress versus real civilization.
If anybody who has run across progress or lack thereof, in any kind of changing ideas and changing, scholarship, it would be John Anthony West. You were, attacked on this stuff and ignored and attacked, and you've had it all happen, so you must know how much progress and anti-progress makes the world turn around.
Yeah.
It's
really a question. You see, this is a very big issue.
Yeah.
Because we are all brought up in a system that calls itself civilization and that has certain assumptions about the past. I call it the Church of Progress because it is a religion. And in fact, if you go to the trouble, it might be interesting to get this latest thing from this clown Shermer about his baloney detector or whatever he calls it. It's a perfect. I mean, Shermer is a lightweight. He's in a world full of intellectual Bernie Madoffs. He's a shoplifter. I mean, he really doesn't count. But, There it is. There it is. All spelled out about what's true and what isn't and what science is and what it isn't and so forth and so on. And so the passion with which anything contrary is combated is in its own way a demonstration of the inadequacy of their own belief system. Because if they really believed that everything was an accident and it all happened through Darwinian evolution, it means a priori that values are entirely subjective and cannot be demonstrated scientifically. So if you love science, I mean, this jerk Shermer talks at the end about, we love science. Well, if you love science, that's not scientific. You can't demonstrate your love for science. You can't measure it. You can't predict from it. It's a completely subjective point of view. And the whole notion that science has actually addressed the truth of, the, let's say, the human situation or even the cosmological situation is a fraud, as it were. It is a religion in its own right, but it's a peculiar religion because it's the belief system of the emotionally defective and the spiritually dyslexic and the philosophically depraved. But it passes off as reason. Now, to change the image a little bit, nobody is surprised when the eunuchs snigger at the Sultan's passion. But when they turn around and decide and call their own terrible disability reason, the empire is doomed. This is the situation that we're in now. We're in the age of the Church of Progress, which is a dogma. It is a spurious religion because the other religions are just degenerate, whereas the Church of Progress is actually a spurious religion based upon absolutely false premises. And the modern situation, where we find ourselves today, buttressed, and this is a big part of my first nonfiction book, which is the Case for Astrology, the Church of Progress, the Jesuits of the Church of Progress, the science, education, and the press. Science invents the dogma. Mm-hmm. The education instills it in unwilling students. Anybody who has even the capacity to think for himself or herself knows how hateful our educational system is. Anybody, mm-hmm. the smarter you are, the more you hated school. Mm-hmm. It's correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You guys like school?
I did not like school at all.
Anybody capable of independent thought or of real thought loathes school, the educational system. And then, of course, the media disseminates the dogma. So we got a problem because we're surrounded by this stuff from the get-go. But enough of us, here we are talking about it, and you've got a show here. Mm-hmm. Enough of us understand that this is bullshit, that we've been conned. But knowing why we're conned or exactly how we're conned and how to get unconned, this is not so easy. So if I were asked to define a real civilization, it's not that difficult. But defining exactly what we mean by the words, this is not so easy. However, a civilization occurs when human beings understand that they are individually and collectively on this planet for a purpose. Mm-hmm. There's a role for humanity within the grand cosmic scheme. And it is the realization of that role, individually and collectively, that produces a civilization. And this is what makes Egypt interesting, because it's the last real civilization that we have any evidence for. Well, put it this way. All of the very distant past had the same understanding. China, India, Mesoamerica, almost certainly. But there isn't that much left of it that you can actually go and experience. With Egypt, it's different because for a variety of strange reasons, it's unique in the sense, it's not even that it's necessarily greater than the other civilizations, but the situation there was such that there's so much of it left. So when you go there, and as you know, I think we haven't talked about this, but I lead, partly because I need the money. Then, even heretics have to live. So I lead these intensive study trips to Egypt, and one of the reasons, one of the gratification, apart from needing it to pay the mortgage, is that people come back from a couple of weeks in Egypt actually understanding the difference between what a real civilization once was like and what we have now and call progress. Because progress is the antithesis of real civilization. It's the absence of meaning. And when you get to Egypt and you spend a couple of weeks, and especially when it comes at you from that symbolist point of view developed by, you know, the great genius Rolla de Lubitsch, but, you know, translated through me. So you feel it. You can't miss it, actually. You go to great lengths to be at places when there's nobody there or as few people there as possible, and early in the morning. And so that you really get this, emotional wallop that particularly of your Americans, you don't get from anything man-made in America. You can get it from nature, all right, but if you're in Europe, you can get it from the great Gothic cathedrals. You can get it, you know, you can get it in other places, but nowhere the way that you get it in Egypt. And when you spend this amount of time in the midst of this absolutely fabulous art and architecture, you get hit by it, and you suddenly understand what it's like or how a civilization that is a real civilization comports itself. In other words, where it places its creativity, its creative energy. And actually, all of history is a complete waste of time, basically. Excuse me for generalizing. Most of it is a complete waste of time. If you want to know about a civilization, you almost don't need facts and names and dates and wars and all of the stuff. If you want to know what a civilization is like, any civilization, you look at where it directs its creative energy. That tells you everything you need to know. And you get to Egypt, this is really interesting, because everything is devoted to this titanic sacred architecture and this magnificent sculpture and art, all of it consecrated to a single issue, the immortality of the soul. Everything in Egypt is devoted to that. The fact that it degenerates over time, this is another big issue. We can spend another 14 or 15 hours of radio time talking about this at some time in the future. But that's what Egypt is about. That's where its energy goes. You look at us now. Where does our creative energy go? Probably about 70% of it into hydrogen bombs and weapons of mass destruction and biochem warfare and genetically modified foods. I'm ballparking it, but let's say 70%. Probably another 20% or so goes into completely useless nonsense, Disney World and Hollywood and iPods and bobblehead dolls.
Well, John,
and all the rest of it. About 2 or 3% somewhere along the line goes into medicine and real science and a couple of things like that. So that tells you, you want to know the difference between the Church of Progress, because that's where the creative energy goes, into violence and stupidity and a little bit into actually furthering knowledge, which one of the interesting things about it is that at least that couple of percent that is devoted to furthering knowledge now gets to the point where we're now able more or less to understand what existed in the very distant past. And suddenly we find that Egypt and ancient Buddhism and ancient India and ancient China understood what the leading edge of cosmologists and astrophysicists are finding out now, except to them it wasn't divorced from the entire civilization, it was integrated into it. Whereas now, to understand these latest wrinkles in cosmological science and physics, you have to be one of them, or at least you need somebody who can explain it to you. I mean, I need somebody to explain it to me. I can't do that now. But in my circuitous fashion, that's the difference between between a church of progress, which is no church at all, and a real civilization, which is what you actually had in the past. And since we see in front of us, you open up the paper, you see the whole of our entire society disintegrating in front of our eyes. So where do we go from here? Well, very interesting, because all of a sudden, within the last 50 years or so, there's enough understood about the past so that you can use it as a model, individually and collectively. Doesn't mean that we're going to build pyramids again or temples of Luxor or anything of the sort, but it means that the principles that fueled those extraordinary civilizations of the past, the principles are eternal. And if you understand what the principles are, at least in theory, you can begin, at least on a small level, on your own individual level, to become civilized again.
Oh,
but otherwise, you're doomed.
Doug, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, I can't think of any better place than Cairo to see both ends of the spectrum.
That's right. That's
because
right.
You've got the pyramids and the Giza Plateau, and then you simply have to turn around and see the mayhem that is Cairo. and you see,
you've been there.
I've not been there yet.
Oh,
but
I've done work with people across the sea.
Yes, we've talked with people who live in Cairo,
and they're like, it's nuts.
And they go, oh yeah, you just look over there, and it's a completely different world. And then right over here, it's a modern city like you're used to.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't get it. How can it be both ends of the spectrum? But it is. So I can't think of a better place than that. So it sounds like it would be a cool thing to head over to Cairo with you. But the thing is, you also mentioned the ancient civilizations and how they had it. And
can I make a comment, Doug?
I really
want to say.
Oh, yes, please.
Because you mentioned, John, I mean, and I can't say, I'm right with you on this idea of creativity. And if you do look at past cultures, you see, I mean, it's all you see is art, all these things, exploring art. And it seems now today, and this
well,
is from personal
well,
experience.
It's gone through a phase. Because remember, John, you were talking about how they were, their art, their architecture, everything was immortality of the soul. It was very spiritual. Then it moved into, like, the Elizabethan times and that kind of thing.
Well, that's a long way off.
Well, tens of thousands of years. But you can see the development, because then it became very sexual, very me kind of thing. It started internalizing it. It went away from the soul.
But it's still
it was always internalized. It started externalizing.
Well, that's it. I'm sorry. It started externalizing.
You watch it through the Renaissance from being, and it's interesting because the Renaissance is supposed to be the beginning of the modern era.
Right.
It's actually a degeneration of what went on before. This is a really interesting and big subject. If you look at medieval art and architecture, it's a big cut above what went on in the Renaissance. In the Renaissance, suddenly there are these titanic genius egos. And boy, they were geniuses too, but they were big egos. In Egypt, and in fact, in the best of medieval Christianity, you walk into the Cathedral of Chartres, I mean, unless there's something wrong with you, boy, it hits you right in the gut. Somebody knew something very important, but nobody signed it. There's nobody, no Michelangelos and no Leonardos and no individuals. It's group genius, as it were. But individual geniuses who do it. And the Renaissance is in a way, it's the beginning of the end. So that now everything is ego, and none of it has because the Renaissance is kind of an in-between stage in which they really are producing gorgeous buildings.
We're not talking about pure. I mean, what you're saying is that, you know, it isn't pure inspiration that's making these things, it seems.
No.
You know, a lot of it comes from the ego nowadays. And that was my point, was that, you know, nowadays, just in the American culture, I mean, if you want to be an artist in the American culture, forget it. I did it for 15 years. Okay? I gave it my best shot. I tried, and I still put food on the table, and I still went to college, and it was a real hard ride, John. And it seems like, you know, back in those times, I mean, expressing yourself and doing this type of expressionist work, art and things like that, it was something that was very much supported. I mean, and you could,
right.
you could get by doing that, but now
right. you can't. Very well.
I mean, you cannot right. be. You can't be an artist now. It seems unless there is it is in an occupational setting environment where you are creating.
Well,
manipulate. I mean,
oh come on! They're calling Miley Cyrus and Hannah Montana an artist,
and that's a business itself. That
that's
complete
just
business.
Business.
That's a good old yeah. boy network. That's what that is.
Well, exactly.
Actually, yeah. It, this is another Ken program.
I know. And we only have 2 minutes to cover it in.
I'll tell you the part. The secret is, one of the secrets in understanding where it is to look at the language that's used. So, for example, the New York Times calls its section devoted to the arts, arts and entertainment. Mm-hmm. Cathedral of Chartres is not entertainment, nor is the pyramid. In other words, everything is a debasing of the creative spirit. And for example, they talk about the entertainment industry. As soon as something is an industry, it means that it's only raison d'être, the reason for its existence. It has just one reason for existence, and that's to make money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what it is, garbage bags, body bags, douche bags, whatever makes the most money is the best industry.
Well,
so
yeah.
when they talk about the, and even my friends, our friends who are our artists, good ones, and public, you know, writers and so on, that's who I deal with, and they talk about the publishing industry. No, there's no publishing industry. There are writers, good ones, not so good ones, bad ones, and then there are bean counters who are parasites who live off us. So as soon as it's recognized that it's a business, you use the right word, but industry is an even better word. When as soon as they talk about the music industry, then there are no musicians or artists or composers anymore. There are only bean counters who sell whatever is saleable, and of course, As an invariable rule, to sell stuff, some sort of talent is necessary. But generally speaking, I mean, you know, the guys who think, you know, Michael Jackson is not a nobody, and he makes $1 jillion because he has something that the other people don't have, an Elvis, and all of these people. But they get swallowed up by the industry. They die. They make all of this money, and for the most part, they lead horrible lives because they are not there. The parasites have the maggots have got hold of them from the get-go and bleed them dry while they make lots of money. Of course, they make money as well, but nothing, they are not permitted, or they can't figure out, I mean, especially when it happens and you're young and you're in your 20s, how the hell do you know any better and suddenly you're making millions of dollars a week?
Right.
How can you not get caught up in your own manufactured image? And so they devour them alive and then spew them out, and they all, for the most part anyway, you know, die these terrible early deaths because they're what make the industry turn, whereas the maggots and the parasites and the wolves and the jackals feed off our creativity, having done nothing themselves but telling us what's going to sell and what's not going to sell. The whole thing is exactly reversed. And that's called progress.
And that's the reason we do Ghostly Talk the way we do. Basically,
right.
It's a
completely independent. We get to do what we want.
We do what we want. No one tells us to do anything.
Right. Except for are out of time.
And this is we're telling ourselves this, John.
We're telling ourselves we're out of time. Do you know, I have to take just a few more seconds to tell you, John. I think you should do an audiobook. You know those...
I know you do
the audio blog. But
yes,
I mean, we listened to Henry Rollins's, he did an, what are they called?
Get in the Van. Well, he had a spoken word performance.
Yeah. Right? And we listened to that. We listened to several of these kinds of things. Oh, David Sedaris does one.
Oh, Sedaris, Sedaris is great, yeah. He's
Hilarious.
Comedy writer,
but he does a spoken word album that just, you could sit there and listen to for hours. And I think I could sit there and listen to you for hours and hours and hours on end and talk about your observations and what you're excited about.
Actually, I've done that. But again, see, I'm my own, like all of us, I'm my own worst enemy. I'm terribly inefficient. And I get stuff going, and unless somebody shows up who has the impresario skills to do something with it,
mm-hmm.
I don't. I mean, I have a comedy show, actually, called Stand Up Metaphysics 3.0, and it's very funny. And it's all
awesome.
The stuff, it's the stuff that we're talking about, but there's a big chunk of that on my blog. It's very unstructured, like the show.
Yeah.
But it's okay. It works. I mean, I've been at this for how long? How old are you guys?
I'm 42. Doug
is older than God.
42.
I'm 34.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. I thought you were younger than that. And how about you, Dan? What?
Well, I'm Scott. I'm 34.
You're Scott. Yeah. Okay. Now I thought you were even. I just from the sound of it and all that, younger than that. But
well, thank you.
Well, you're at this stuff long enough. I mean, even things like you say that 4 years ago is a long time. You got my age. 4 years ago is yesterday.
It's a blink of the eye. Yes, I know.
But anyway, yeah. This is the problem because it's an industry. I need somebody. We need somebody special to say, gee, we can make money out of that.
Otherwise,
it doesn't happen. So the people who are in a position who have the kinds of, let's say, organizational skills to get this stuff out there aren't interested because it doesn't look like money to them.
Right. That's the problem. So, the bean counters aren't sitting there
that's
going,
right.
Oh, this
represents money. So what
money.
You need is, I mean, most of my friends, if you know, do you know who Diaghilev was?
Diaghilev?
No. Diaghilev. Diaghilev was the great gay Russian impresario. I mean, he was a real wild man who brought the Ballet Russe to Paris in the before World War One, and it was Diaghilev's genius as this great visionary impresario that without Diaghilev you probably never would have heard of Stravinsky and a whole bunch of the great musicians and ballet stuff that was going on out of the World War One and then the 20s and 30s. Because they had this mad, he was a wild man, but a genius impresario who could actually make the stuff work. Then the creative people in this goofy society, we need that sort of thing, or we don't function. I mean, we do our little bit of a thing, and, you know, whoever hears of us, yeah, a little bit here, a little bit there. But not so very long ago, as you were saying, where the arts were recognized as being integral to life. The life wasn't life without real artists and really creative
that
people.
So
even though, you know, the Borgias and the Medicis and, you know, were sort of monsters in their way. They was a violent, dangerous people. A lot of their time and energy went into furthering the creativity that gave us the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's exactly the opposite. To get anywhere, I mean, even to do what we're doing is a titanic struggle.
Oh, yeah. Completely. John, hang on
for
1 second.
So
we got just hang on the line. Don't leave us just yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hang tight for 1 second. We do have to close the show out, Doug.
Yes.
I think Doug, you're on top of that.
What a blast! We talked.
Oh,
about,
yeah, man. We could
we talked about 10 to 36,000 years ago. With John Anthony West, thank you very much. The website is www.jawest.net, and of course now we've gone dual website and www.jawest.com.
This is the big time.
This is the big time now. And of course, before that, we were talking with Ben Stecker about his UFO abduction and then all the weird things that happened to him after that. That just sort of added up to it added up to his book, The Atlantis Conspiracy. And we're going to put a link to that on our website. Our website is, of course, www.ghostlytalk.com. I would like to thank the shows that gave us 6 minutes or 7 minutes, whatever we're over.
They're going
to
hurt us.
Thank you so much.
No, it's okay.
Because
that's cool.
I love talking
with it was worth
with,
every second of it.
Absolutely. John Anthony West, wow. What a time. And John Keel, wherever you are,
yeah,
rest in peace, yeah. And thank you for all that mind-altering and inspiring stuff that you did.
Rest in peace. Make trouble.
Make trouble. Make trouble for all of us.
Speaking of making trouble.
I'm going out to make some trouble right now. For this week, this has been Ghostly Talk, and I've been Doug.
I've been Scott L.
Amber.
See you guys.
Here with you.
I was
Yay. She was. See you guys later.